So in the 1950s, there was this Japanese washing machine manufacturer that just ran into this completely bizarre, like escalating crisis that was utterly baffling their engineering team.
Right.
They had just rolled out this brand new line of machines, and almost immediately, I mean, literally right away, these angry letters started just pouring in from rural farming
Oh
communities.
no.
Yeah. And the machines were breaking down at this alarming rate. Motors were burning out, agitators were snapping in half, and the internal mechanisms were just completely failing.
That is a nightmare for an engineering team.
Totally. So, the company sends out a team of investigators to figure out, like, what kind of catastrophic manufacturing defect is actually causing this.
Naturally.
So they go to these farms, they walk into the barns, and they discover that the farmers are not actually putting dirty clothes into these washing machines.
Wait, what were they putting in them?
They were filling them to the absolute brim with freshly harvested, completely dirt-caked potatoes.
Oh my gosh, it is just such a spectacular image. You can just sort of imagine the engineer standing there staring at a machine violently shaking while trying to launder root vegetables.
Right. I mean, if the farmers saw this large tub that spins water around and thought, well, perfect.
Right.
This will save us days of manual labor washing our crop.
Which is pretty innovative, honestly.
It is. But the engineers, on the other hand, had designed a highly delicate system meant for, cotton and wool. And that story is really the perfect entry point for what we are tackling today in this deep dive.
It really is.
Because if you look at your own life, whether it is a persistent bottleneck in your department at work or a corporate policy that seems to just create more fires than it puts out, you are likely interacting with a system without actually understanding what that system is built to do.
Yeah, and that is a massive problem because we live in a reality that is entirely composed of complex, deeply interwoven systems, but our brains are, they are just not trained to see them.
We are so focused on the immediate problem.
Exactly. We are trained to view the world through a highly simplified linear cause and effect lens. We just think A causes B. I push the button, the machine turns on.
Right.
But reality is actually circular. Reality is a complex web of feedback loops and hidden structures. And when we try to solve these complex problems with linear thinking, we end up just like those engineers.
Frustrated that the machine is broken.
Yes, completely frustrated and totally blind to the fact that it is being used for potatoes.
So our mission for this deep dive is to give you, the listener, a shortcut out of that linear trap. We are going to explore how to become system-wise.
I love that term.
We want to get you to stop playing whack-a-mole with your daily fires and start redesigning the underlying architecture that actually generates those fires in the first place.
Which is the only way to create real change.
Exactly. We are pulling insights today from an incredibly insightful primer called Introduction to Systems Thinking by Daniel H. Kim. Okay, let's unpack this, because before we can diagnose a broken system, we have to rigorously define what a system actually is.
Yes, because we use that word all the time.
We really do. We say things like the healthcare system or my filing system, but most of what we call systems are actually just collections.
And that distinction, the difference between a collection and a system, is completely foundational. A system is a group of interacting, interrelated, or interdependent parts that form a complex and unified whole.
Interdependent is the key word there, wow.
Absolutely. And crucially, it must have a specific purpose. If you do not have interdependence, you do not have a system. You really just have a pile of stuff.
So there is this brilliant subtraction test in the source material to figure out which one you are actually looking at. Take a toolbox filled with hammers, wrenches, and screwdrivers.
Okay.
If you remove the wrench, what happens to the toolbox?
Well, nothing.
Exactly, nothing happens. You just have a toolbox with one fewer tool in it. The screwdriver doesn't suddenly stop functioning just because the wrench is gone. They are completely independent of one another.
Right, they don't care about each other.
Exactly. That is a collection. Same with a bowl of fruit or a database of customer names.
Yeah.
You delete a name, the database still holds names.
Contrast that with, say, a toaster or a football team. Those are systems.
Because all the parts matter.
Yes, if you pull the heating element out of a toaster, you don't just have a smaller toaster, you have a broken piece of metal that cannot achieve its purpose of browning bread. Every single part must be present.
And order matters too, right?
Totally. Beyond just being present, the order is critical. You cannot take the spark plugs out of a car engine, throw them in the trunk, and expect the car to start.
To put my own spin on it, a collection is sort of like a Spotify playlist. You can shuffle the songs, you can delete a track, and it is still a playlist. The songs do not interrelate.
That is a great way to look at it.
But a system is like a live jazz quartet. If the drummer suddenly changes the tempo, the bassist has to instantly adapt, which shifts what the pianist is doing, which completely alters the trumpet solo. They are deeply interrelated.
That interdependence is the defining feature.
But I have to admit, I kind of tripped over one of the examples of a collection that the text brings up, a kitchen.
Ah, yes, the kitchen example.
The argument is that a kitchen is just a collection, not a system. But wait, a kitchen is full of complicated appliances.
Mm-hmm.
It has plumbing, electrical wiring, gas lines. How on earth is a kitchen not a system?
I completely see why that feels counterintuitive, because a kitchen contains many complex systems within it.
Right.
The refrigerator is a closed system. The dishwasher is a system. But the room itself, the actual kitchen, is just a holding area for a collection of appliances.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Think about it. The refrigerator does not interrelate interdependently with the oven. If you unplug the oven and drag it out into the driveway, the refrigerator just happily continues to keep your milk cold.
I see. They don't rely on each other.
Exactly. They do not rely on one another to achieve a unified purpose. But, and this is where it gets absolutely fascinating, there's a massive caveat in the text.
Okay, what is it?
The moment you introduce a human being into that kitchen, it almost instantly transforms into a system.
Oh, wow. Because the human becomes the interdependent link.
Precisely.
If I am cooking dinner, I grab butter from the fridge, which I melt on the stove, while I rinse vegetables in the sink. My actions weave those completely isolated appliances into a unified, interdependent process.
And if you add a second human, say someone trying to make a sandwich, while you were cooking a massive dinner, you now have a highly complex social and physical system.
Oh, yeah. A very stressful system.
Very stressful. You are bumping into each other. You are competing for counter space, negotiating the use of the sink. The elements are now deeply interdependent.
So adding humans to a collection almost always weaves those disparate parts into a complex system of behaviors, routines, and conflicting purposes.
Yes. Humans are the ultimate system makers.
I want you, the listener, to just pause for a second and look at your own workplace. Think about your department.
It is a great exercise.
Are the people in your office actually operating as an interdependent system with a unified purpose? Or are you all just acting like a collection of tools sitting in a proverbial toolbox?
That is the million-dollar question.
Do you have people just doing their own isolated tasks, never interrelating, completely unaffected if the person at the desk next to them is struggling? Because if you are just a collection, you can never achieve the complex outputs of a true system.
Which really brings us to the driving force of all of this. If interrelatedness is the physical structure of a system, then purpose is its heartbeat.
A purpose.
Yes. To understand why any system behaves the way it does, you have to uncover its purpose. But that purpose is a property of the whole, not of the individual parts.
Going back to the car example, the purpose of an engine is not transportation. An engine just sitting on a pallet in a warehouse isn't transporting anyone anywhere. The purpose of transportation belongs exclusively to the unified system of the car.
Exactly. And with mechanical, human-made systems, that purpose is completely hardwired into the design.
Like the washing machine.
Yes. The Japanese engineers designed the washing machine to clean clothes. That was its hardwired purpose. But as we saw with the potato farmers, human beings can easily impose an entirely different perceived purpose onto a system.
And the machine doesn't care.
No, the machine doesn't care at all. It just operates until the imposed purpose completely destroys its physical limits.
And if mechanical systems are prone to being misunderstood, natural and social systems are an absolute nightmare to figure out.
Oh, totally.
I mean, we didn't build them, so they don't come with a user manual. We just have to guess their purpose based on how they behave.
Look at the human lung. For centuries, humans smoked tobacco. We knew lungs were for breathing, sure, but our understanding of the lung as a microscopic cellular system was incredibly superficial.
We didn't understand the depth of it.
Not at all. We didn't understand its deeply complex systemic purpose, you know, oxygen exchange, filtering, cellular regeneration. We didn't know it well enough to realize that introducing aerosolized tar over decades would mutate the cells and cause cancer.
So we were basically imposing our desired purpose onto it.
Exactly. We imposed pleasure or stress relief onto a system we fundamentally didn't understand. What is fascinating here is how often we impose our own assumed purpose onto natural or social systems and then are just completely shocked when the system breaks down or fights back.
You see this in social structures all the time. Think about how different cultures view dogs.
Oh, that is a great example.
Right. In one culture, The social system is built around the dog as a beloved family member. The dog sleeps in the bed, gets premium health care, has a literal birthday party.
Which is very common here.
Yeah. The entire systemic structure supports the purpose of companionship. But in another culture, a dog is viewed strictly as a utility, like a guard animal or even a source of food.
Completely different purposes driving completely different behaviors.
And if you don't recognize what the assumed purpose of a social system actually is, your actions will inevitably cause a breakdown. If you try to manage a team of creatives like they are an assembly line, imposing the purpose of standardized output onto a system whose actual purpose is novel innovation, the system will fight back.
It has to fight back to survive.
People will quit, the work will suffer. The system maintains its integrity.
So how does a system actually maintain its integrity? How does it fight back?
With feedback, right?
Yes. It uses feedback. Now, when most people hear the word feedback, they think of an annual performance review.
Or like a customer survey.
Right. But in systems thinking, feedback has a very specific mechanical definition. It is simply the transmission and return of information. It is how the system knows where it is relative to where it wants to be.
Okay, so how does that work in practice?
Well, the human body is a masterpiece of feedback. Your body has a desired state, which is a core temperature of 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right.
If you go for a 5-mile run, your muscles generate heat. Your core temperature rises to 99, maybe 100 degrees.
Which is the transmission of information.
Exactly. The system registers this information, this feedback, and triggers your sweat glands. The moisture hits your skin, the air evaporates it, and that cooling effect drives your temperature back down. The system survives through that constant flow of returning information.
Or think about driving a car. When you take a sharp curve on a highway, you don't just lock the steering wheel at a 45-degree angle, close your eyes, and pray.
I certainly hope not.
You are constantly taking in feedback. You feel the G-force pulling your body. You see the lane line shifting in your peripheral vision. And you use that returning information to make micro-adjustments to the wheel and the pedals. It is a continuous loop.
It is. And the danger is that because we often misunderstand a system's true purpose, we misinterpret the feedback.
That makes sense.
When something goes wrong in an organization, we get trapped reacting to the surface level symptoms. We see a drop in sales, so we yell at the sales team. We don't look at the underlying structural feedback mechanisms that actually caused the drop.
Which means we need a framework to look beneath the surface. And I think it is time we dive into the iceberg model.
Yes, the iceberg model is crucial.
If you want to become system-wise, this is the blueprint. Just like a physical iceberg, what you see above the water is only a tiny fraction of the reality.
Mm-hmm.
The massive, dangerous bulk of the ice is hidden deep underwater.
The iceberg model gives us 4 distinct levels of reality. The very top, the part sticking out of the water, is what we call events.
And events are just the things that happen.
Right. Events are simply what is happening right now. You catch a cold, the fire alarm goes off, a highly defective product comes off your assembly line.
Events are where we spend 99% of our lives. We are constantly putting out the immediate fires.
We are.
But if you look just below the waterline, you hit the second layer, which is patterns. So patterns are basically the accumulated memories of events over time.
Exactly.
It is not just that you caught a cold today. It is noticing the pattern that you catch a cold every single time you sleep less than 5 hours for a week straight.
In a corporate setting, a pattern isn't just one defective product. It is the realization that defects reliably spike by 40% every Tuesday during the shift change.
Recognizing a pattern is better than just reacting to an event, definitely.
It is, but it still doesn't tell you why it is happening. For that, we have to go deeper into the water to the third layer, which is systemic structures.
This is where things get real. Systemic structures are how the parts of the system are actually organized, either physically or socially.
Right.
So if the pattern is a spike in defects during the shift change, the systemic structure causing that might be the HR scheduling system.
Let's use that example.
Let's say the schedule is built. So the morning crew leaves at exactly 3 p.m. and the evening crew arrives at exactly 3 p.m. There is zero overlap.
None at all.
The physical reality of that structure guarantees a messy handoff. Information gets lost, machines are left unattended for 5 minutes, and that structure generates the pattern of errors, which results in the event of a defective product.
Now, most management consultants will actually stop right there. They find the broken structure, they rewrite the schedule, and they call it a day.
But systems thinking demands we go further.
It demands we go to the deepest, darkest part of the iceberg. Beneath systemic structures, we find mental models.
Mental models.
Yes. Mental models are the deeply held beliefs, assumptions, and paradigms we hold about how the world works. They are the invisible blueprints that create the physical structures.
I really want to dissect this because this is the bridge that usually confuses people.
Yep.
How does an abstract thought, like a mental model, turn into a physical factory schedule? Walk me through that actual mechanism.
Okay, imagine the manager who originally wrote that factory schedule. Why did they create a schedule with zero overlap?
To save money.
Exactly. They didn't do it to cause defects. They did it because they hold a specific mental model about labor. Perhaps their mental model is hourly workers are a cost to be minimized, and paying two crews for a 15-minute overlap is a waste of money.
I see.
Or look at the workers themselves. Their mental model might be, I am only responsible for my specific machine between 7 a.m. and 3 p.m. What happens at 1 p.m. is not my problem.
Which limits their personal mastery of the entire process.
Exactly. Those limiting beliefs dictate the decisions made in the boardroom, which physically manifest as the printed schedule on the wall.
It is the invisible belief system that actually builds the physical world. That is wild.
It is. But there is actually one more layer right at the absolute bottom tip of the iceberg, and that is vision.
Vision. Got it.
Vision is the guiding picture of the future. It is what the organization ultimately desires. If the worker's mental model is, I only care about my shift, that stems from a vision where every shift is siloed.
Like they're actively competing with the others for bonuses.
Right, rather than a shared vision of total company quality.
The causality flows completely from the bottom up. The vision dictates the mental models. The mental models generate the systemic structures. The structures cause the patterns, and the patterns result in the events we see above the water.
You've got it perfectly.
But our brains are fundamentally opposed to looking at the bottom of the iceberg. We are evolutionarily wired to obsess over the tip.
We are.
If you are a hunter-gatherer 50,000 years ago, and a saber-toothed tiger jumps out of a bush, that is an event. Your survival depends on immediate reactive panic.
Right. If you pause while the tiger is chasing you to ponder the systemic structures that led the tiger to your territory, you know, perhaps a subtle shift in the prey migration patterns caused by a prolonged drought.
You are going to get eaten.
You are absolutely going to get eaten. We survived as a species by reacting to events.
But in a modern organizational setting, that caveman wiring destroys us. We spend all day running from tigers, just putting out fires, answering urgent emails, throwing away defective parts.
Yes, and if we want to actually fix the events, we have to start at the bottom.
So if the factory workers established a true shared vision, like a unified commitment to producing the highest quality product, regardless of whose shift it is.
Yes, team learning and a shared vision.
Right. That shared vision would force a shift in their mental models. They would no longer see themselves as isolated cogs. That new mental model would demand a new systemic structure, like a mandatory 15-minute shift overlap for knowledge transfer.
Exactly. And that new structure would change the pattern of errors, and the event of the defective product would simply vanish.
I want to turn this directly to you, the listener. Think about the problem of practice you are currently facing in your organization, the one that keeps you up at night.
We all have one.
Are you just frantically reacting to the events? Are you just wiping up the water on the floor every single day? How might establishing a genuine shared vision with your team change their deeply entrenched mental models?
And if those mental models shifted, how would that subsequently force a redesign of the actual structures that are causing the leak in the first place?
Once you identify those structures, you need a language to talk about how they operate. Because, as we said earlier, they don't operate in straight lines. They operate in circular feedback loops.
Yes, loops.
The architecture of these systems is built on two primary foundations, right? Reinforcing loops and balancing loops.
Let's start with reinforcing loops. These are the engines of growth and collapse.
Engines of growth.
Yes. They happen when a system has positive feedback that compounds change in one continuous direction. Every action adds to the previous action, accelerating the outcome.
The classic example is a savings account with compound interest. You put $100 in the bank, it earns interest, so now you have $105.
Right.
The next time interest is calculated, it's not calculated on the $100, it is calculated on the $105, generating a slightly larger payout,
right,
which creates an even larger balance for the next round. It just spirals upward.
In business, we call this a virtuous cycle. It is the holy grail of viral marketing.
Oh yeah, one customer loves your product, they tell three friends. Those three friends buy it and tell nine friends. the growth compounds exponentially.
But here is the terrifying thing about reinforcing loops. They are completely amoral.
What do you mean by amoral?
They do not care about your business goals. The exact same mathematical structure that creates viral growth will create a death spiral.
Oh, right.
Let's say those first three customers hate your product. They generate negative word of mouth. Sales drop. Because revenue drops, you panic and cut the R&D budget to save money.
Which makes the product worse.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That causes the quality of the product to drop further, which generates even worse reviews, which drops sales even faster. The loop accelerates the collapse just as efficiently as it accelerated the growth.
If systems were only made of reinforcing loops, the entire world would just be things exploding into infinity or collapsing into dust.
And it'd be chaos.
But that isn't reality. Things are generally pretty stable. And that stability is provided by the second foundation, which is balancing loops.
Balancing loops are the great stabilizers of reality. If reinforcing loops resist equilibrium, balancing loops exist solely to maintain it.
To maintain the status quo.
Yes. Their entire purpose is to resist change and keep the system at a desired level of performance.
We talked about the thermostat earlier. That is a perfect mechanical balancing loop. The system has a desired state, say 70 degrees.
Right.
It has an actual state, like the current room temperature is 60 degrees. Balancing loops are always driven by the gap between the desired state and the actual state.
The gap is the key.
Whenever a gap exists, the system takes corrective action. The furnace turns on, the temperature rises. As the gap shrinks, the corrective action slows down. When the gap is zero, the action stops completely.
I want to push on why balancing loops are so difficult to manage in an organization, though.
Why is that?
They are incredibly hard to see because their entire job is to keep things exactly as they are. You do not notice when things remain the same.
That is so true.
You only notice balancing loops when they fail. You don't think about your car's radiator until the engine is literally smoking on the side of the highway.
Let me challenge this a bit, though. I understand how a balancing loop works for a thermostat or a radiator, where the goal is a hard, measurable number. 70 degrees, 200 miles per hour. But what about a creative agency? What about a team where the desired state is high-quality design or excellent customer service? How does a balancing loop operate when the goal is completely subjective?
That is a phenomenal question, and it really strikes at the heart of organizational dysfunction.
Yeah.
In a subjective environment, the balancing loop still exists, but the desired state is often a moving target, or it is completely misaligned among the team.
Misaligned gaps.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If the creative director's desired state is avant-garde, award-winning design, but the client's desired state is safe, corporate branding, there are two conflicting balancing loops operating simultaneously.
Oh, wow.
The team will produce a draft. The director will push it to be edgier to close their gap, and the client will reject it because it widened their gap.
Which means all managerial responsibilities, you know, budgeting, damage control, quality assurance, they are fundamentally just balancing processes.
They really are.
To be a great manager is to master the balancing loop. You have to clearly define the desired state, accurately measure the actual state, and apply the exact right amount of corrective action to close the gap.
But applying the exact right amount of action is where things go horribly wrong.
Because of the troublemakers.
Yes. Because every balancing loop is infected by two massive troublemakers, perception and delays.
Let's tackle perception first. There was a concept here in the source material I love called the good, the bad, and the ugly of balancing loops.
It is a great framework.
The good is your desired goal, let's say, building a high-quality laptop. The bad is the actual situation. Maybe the laptop hinges are currently a bit flimsy.
Right.
The gap between those two is what triggers your engineering team to improve the design. But then you introduce the ugly, which is human perception. We almost never operate on objective reality. We operate on our perception of reality.
Hewlett-Packard actually learned this the hard way in the early days of personal computers.
Oh, the HP portable computer story.
Yes. HP wanted to enter the portable computer market. Their internal cultural mental model was that HP built the highest quality, most indestructible instruments on Earth.
That was their standard.
That was their desired state gap. They wanted rugged perfection.
So they built a portable computer that you could probably drop out of an airplane.
Basically, yes.
But they completely ignored the customer's perceived quality gap. The customers wanted a computer that was rugged enough to survive a commute, but primarily they needed it to be affordable.
Right. Affordability was their main gap.
HP's indestructible computers were so incredibly expensive that nobody bought them. HP was frantically managing the wrong gap because their perception of what quality meant was totally divorced from the market's perception.
And perceptual distortion is exponentially worsened by the concept of delays.
Delays are the worst.
In systems thinking, a delay is the amount of time it takes for an action to travel through the loop and manifest as a result. Every single link in every system contains a delay. Sometimes it is milliseconds, sometimes it is decades.
There are four distinct flavors of delay in the text, and breaking these down really exposes why organizations move so slowly.
Let's walk through them. The first flavor is physical delay.
Okay.
This is the inescapable reality of physics. It is the time it takes for atoms to move or transform. Shipping a cargo container from Shenzhen to Los Angeles takes physical time. Growing a tree to harvest for lumber takes physical time.
You cannot manage your way out of physics.
No, you can't.
The second is transactional delay. This is the bureaucracy bottleneck. The physical product might be completely finished, just sitting on a loading dock, but it can't move because it takes 2 weeks to negotiate the shipping contract or 3 days to get the VP to sign the approval form.
We all know that pain. The third is informational delay. This is the gap between the transmission of a message and the actual comprehension of that message.
Oh, like when a CEO makes an announcement.
Exactly. A CEO can stand on a stage and announce a massive pivot in company strategy. The transmission takes 5 minutes. But the informational delay, the time it takes for 10,000 employees to actually digest that information, understand how it affects their daily tasks, and align with it, that could take 6 months.
Which leads to the fourth, and by far the most dangerous flavor, perceptual delay.
Yes.
This happens when the physical reality has changed, the transactions are done, the information is out there, but our deeply entrenched mental models take a massive amount of time to catch up.
Think about brand reputation. A car company might spend 5 years building cheap, unreliable cars. Then they get a new CEO, overhaul their factories, and start producing the most reliable cars on the road.
The physical reality of the car has completely changed.
It has. But the perceptual delay in the market is staggering. Consumers will still view that brand as cheap and unreliable for years, purely based on old mental models.
I always think of this like a restaurant getting a new chef.
Oh, I like that.
Let's say a local diner is known for having terrible, greasy food. Then, out of nowhere, they hire a Michelin star chef. The physical reality changes overnight. The food is instantly incredible.
Right.
But the dining room stays empty for 8 months because everyone in town still perceives it as a greasy spoon. The perception just hasn't caught up to the reality.
Exactly.
But this creates a massive problem for leadership. If perceptual delays take so long to resolve, are managers constantly making decisions based on obsolete data?
Yes, they are constantly overcorrecting because they don't see the results of their actions immediately.
It is exactly like taking a shower in a cheap hotel with old plumbing.
That is the perfect analogy.
Right. You get in, the water is freezing. That is your gap. So you turn the dial to hot. But there's a physical delay as the hot water travels 3 floors up the pipes.
And you don't feel it right away.
Exactly. Because you don't feel the heat instantly, your perception is that you didn't turn the dial enough, so you violently crank it to maximum heat.
Which is a terrible idea.
10 seconds later, the scalding water finally hits you. You panic and crank the dial all the way back to cold. You stand there just oscillating between freezing and burning because you are reacting to delayed information.
To see just how catastrophic it is when executives ignore these delays, we really need to walk through two specific organizational case studies from the text.
Let's do it.
Let's look at Fitco first. Fitco is a hypothetical exercise equipment manufacturer, but their story is a masterclass in how a company can completely design its own bankruptcy by mismanaging delays.
Fitco starts out in a really great position. They make a really good treadmill. Because the quality is high, customer demand starts to rise. This is the beginning of a virtuous reinforcing loop.
Yes.
But as demand goes up, the pressure on the manufacturing floor skyrockets. The workers are doing overtime. The machines are running hot.
And management sees this rising demand.
Right. The logical move is to build a new factory to increase capacity. But management hesitates.
They look at the data and think, well, what if this is just a New Year's resolution fad? We don't want to spend $10 million on a new factory if demand is going to evaporate in March.
That hesitation is the fatal flaw.
It is. Because they don't expand capacity, the production pressure keeps mounting, the overworked staff starts making mistakes, the machines aren't getting maintenance, so they lose calibration.
And as a direct physical result of this pressure, the actual quality of the treadmills begins to plummet.
And here is where the math of delays destroys them. Customers notice the bad quality very quickly. The perceptual delay of a broken treadmill is short.
Because it breaks while you're running on it.
Exactly. So orders get canceled, negative reviews pile up, demand starts to drop.
Right at this exact moment, Fitco management finally caves and says, okay, the initial demand was real, let's authorize the new factory.
But the physical and transactional delays of building a new factory are massive. It takes 18 months to buy the land, pour the concrete, install the robots, and hire the staff.
Meanwhile, the delay of customers leaving due to bad quality is only a few weeks.
Yes. The customers are fleeing at lightning speed while the solution is moving at a snail's pace.
So 6 months into building the new factory, quality is still terrible, and demand has fallen off a cliff. Management looks at the plummeting sales graph, completely panics, and pulls the plug.
They cancel the factory construction midway through.
And they say, look at the data. Demand is falling. We were right to be cautious in the first place. They literally pat themselves on the back for their prudent financial judgment.
It is a profound systemic tragedy. From inside the boardroom, they honestly believe they are making data-driven decisions.
But they're not.
They are completely blind to the fact that their initial hesitation caused the production pressure, which caused the quality drop, which caused the demand to crash.
Their actions were a self-fulfilling prophecy.
They reacted to the event of falling demand, totally ignorant of the systemic structure that forced the downward spiral.
That is haunting, because you can see how easily a smart executive could fall into that trap.
Oh, absolutely.
But let's look at the second case study, which is even more relatable if you manage a team. This is the story of DevOrCorp and a manager named Toby.
Toby's situation is a perfect illustration of a systems archetype known as fixes that backfire.
Fixes that backfire.
Yes. This is what happens when well-intentioned, proactive management produces the exact opposite of the desired result.
So Toby is a mid-level manager overseeing a massive hardware development project. Hundreds of engineers, thousands of parts. He notices a troubling event. A significant number of parts are falling behind schedule.
The gap between desired completion and actual completion is widening.
Right. So Toby applies a logical reactive fix.
Oh.
He decides the engineers need tighter supervision. He institutes mandatory weekly review meetings where every engineer has to stand up and aggressively justify why their parts are late.
And initially, Toby's fix actually appears to work.
Because of the pressure.
Yes. He applies intense pressure, the engineers scramble, and the late parts start moving briskly through the pipeline. The gap closes. Toby feels like a great manager.
But then, a month later, the problem returns. Even more parts are late.
Right.
So Toby applies the exact same fix, but harder. More meetings. Harsher scrutiny. Things improve slightly, but not as fast. And as the monks roll on, the harder Toby pushes, the worse the schedule gets. The project just grinds to an absolute halt.
Why did the fix backfire? If we map the causal loop, we uncover the hidden structure.
Okay, what is it?
First, there is a physical reality. Toby's mandatory review meetings took time. Every hour an engineer spent sitting in a conference room preparing PowerPoint slides was an hour they were not at their desk actually designing the parts.
The fix mathematically subtracted time from the solution.
Yes, but the psychological reality is even worse. The engineers hated the browbeating. They hated being publicly shamed in these meetings.
Understandably.
So what did? They changed their mental model to protect themselves. They started hiding problems.
Oh, wow.
If an engineer knew a part was going to be late on Tuesday, they wouldn't report it. They would hide the delay until Friday, desperately hoping they could fix it in secret before the next meeting.
This withholding of information injected massive informational delays into the entire system.
Exactly. Because problems were hidden, downstream engineers didn't know that their dependent parts were going to be late.
The entire architecture of the project became brittle because nobody was telling the truth.
Toby's attempt to fix the problem by adding pressure directly birthed a new invisible structure, the systemic hiding of information, and that magnified the original delay exponentially.
So if you are Toby and you realize you have accidentally designed a system of terror and deceit, how do you actually get out of it?
The text introduces a brutal, counterintuitive principle called worse before better.
Worse before better. Okay.
To fix a broken system, you often have to endure a period where the metrics look terrible. Toby had to fundamentally shift his action mode.
He had to change his approach.
He had to cancel the review meetings, stand in front of his team, and explicitly promise that there would be zero penalties for reporting problems early. He had to foster a mental model of psychological safety.
But the moment he does that, what happens? All the engineers who have been secretly hiding their late parts for weeks suddenly feel safe to confess.
Right.
So on paper, the official number of late parts skyrockets overnight. The dashboard turns completely red.
The system has to get worse before it can get better. If Toby panics when the numbers spike and brings the meetings back, he destroys the trust forever.
He has to hold his nerve.
Allow the hidden reality to surface and trust that removing the informational delay will eventually allow the system to stabilize and heal.
Toby and his engineers didn't want the project to fail. They all wanted to succeed. Yet, because they were entirely blind to the feedback loops and delays, they unconsciously colluded to build a systemic structure that guaranteed their own failure.
Both Fitco and Toby were victims of the exact same foundational error. They were working in the system, reacting to daily events, rather than working on the system to alter its underlying architecture. And this brings us to the ultimate application of systems thinking, which is shifting your leverage.
There's an analogy here that I think crystallizes the entire concept.
Mm-hmm.
If you are flying on a commercial airline, who has the most impact on the success of your flight?
Well, most of us would instinctively say the pilot.
Or maybe the flight attendants, because that is who we interact with. But the pilot is merely working in the system. They are managing the immediate events of the flight, you know, the wind, the altitude.
Right.
If a wing snaps off, the pilot's skill is totally irrelevant. The person with the actual ultimate influence on your survival is the aircraft designer.
Yes.
The designer works on the system. If we want vastly better outcomes in our organizations, we have to stop trying to be heroic pilots and start becoming aircraft designers.
And to become a designer, you have to master the five action modes.
The five action modes.
Yes. These modes correlate directly back to the iceberg model, and they dictate exactly how much leverage you are applying to a problem.
Let's walk through these five modes in detail, and let's apply them directly to Toby's situation at DevWare to see how a manager evolves. The first is reactive action. This corresponds to the tip of the iceberg, events.
Reactive action is pure survival. It is Toby seeing a late part and immediately reassigning three engineers to work overtime to fix that one specific part.
It's just putting out a fire.
It offers very low leverage for long-term change, but, well, it is necessary if the building is actively burning down.
The second mode is adaptive action. This corresponds to patterns.
Okay.
Toby notices that parts are always late during the testing phase. And adaptive action isn't fixing the root cause. It is just adapting to the reality. Toby simply pads the schedule.
He tells the client testing will take 3 weeks instead of one, absorbing the blow of the delay without actually improving the engineering.
The third mode is where we start actually working on the system. Creative action. This corresponds to systemic structures.
This is Toby realizing the workflow is broken. He redesigns the reporting software so that downstream engineers automatically get pinged the moment an upstream part is modified.
He is physically creating a new structure to eliminate the informational delay.
Exactly.
The fourth mode is reflective action, which corresponds to mental models. Before Toby can get the engineers to use that new software honestly, he has to reflect on why they were hiding information in the first place.
He has to sit down with his team and openly challenge the belief that reporting a problem means you are a bad engineer. He has to dismantle that mental model of fear.
And finally, the absolute highest point of leverage is the fifth mode, generative action. This corresponds to the very bottom of the iceberg, vision.
Generative action is bringing a totally new shared commitment into existence. It is Toby painting a compelling, unifying picture of a future where the team operates with radical transparency.
Where problems are viewed as puzzles to solve together rather than personal failures.
Yes. That generative vision changes the mental models, which allows the creative structures to function, completely eliminating the events of hidden delays.
But there is a massive, incredibly important caveat to all of this. Leverage is relative to the immediate context.
Yes. Generative and reflective actions are incredibly powerful, but they are slow. They take deep psychological work.
Right.
If you are standing in the middle of an intersection and a city bus is hurtling toward you at 50 miles an hour, that is absolutely not the time to be reflective about the mental models of the bus driver.
No, it is not.
It is not the time to be generative about redesigning public transportation infrastructure. You need to be highly reactive and dive out of the way. You must accurately match your action mode to the temporal reality of the threat.
Don't analyze the bus, just move. So I want to bring this all back to you, the listener, and that persistent problem of practice we asked you to think about an hour ago.
Yes, think about that problem.
In your daily attempts to solve it, Are you acting as a pilot, just frantically pulling levers and hitting buttons as the alarms scream in the cockpit? Or are you acting as an aircraft designer?
It is a profound shift.
How could adopting a truly generative systems thinking approach, you know, starting with a shared vision to completely rewrite the underlying mental models of your team, help you redesign your organization from the ground up?
It requires an often uncomfortable shift in how we process reality. It means intentionally stepping back from the seductive, adrenaline-pumping urgency of daily fires.
It requires mapping out the hidden reinforcing and balancing loops, explicitly naming the delays.
And having the sheer managerial courage to endure that worse before a better transition period as you dismantle the broken structures.
We have covered incredible ground in this deep dive. We started by drawing a hard definitional line between mere collections and truly interdependent systems.
Discovering that adding a human being to the mix changes everything.
We dove deep beneath the surface of the iceberg to expose how our unexamined, often flawed mental models and visions are secretly dictating the physical structures that cause the daily events we struggle with.
We mapped the circular compounding logic of reinforcing engines and the invisible stabilization of balancing loops.
And we exposed the hidden troublemakers, the physical, transactional, informational, and perceptual delays that caused Fitco to spiral into bankruptcy and DevWare's Toby to accidentally sabotage his own team.
Most importantly, we learned that to stop reacting to the system, we have to seize the highest leverage points and become the designers of it.
It is a dense, complex, new vocabulary. But once you start seeing the world in loops and structures rather than straight lines, the fog lifts.
You realize just how much agency and leverage you actually have to shape the future of your organization and your life.
I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over, drawing on that fascinating caveat we mentioned right at the beginning. Remember that adding humans to a mere collection almost always weaves it into an interdependent system. I want you to think beyond your workplace. Think about your own friend groups, your extended family unit, or your professional networking circles. What unspoken, entirely hidden purpose is your social system currently organized to achieve without you even realizing it?
That is a powerful question.
Is it organized for mutual growth? Or is it secretly structured to maintain a comfortable stagnation? And as you navigate those relationships tomorrow, are you just going to keep reacting to the surface level events? Or are you finally ready to start redesigning the structure?